Welcome to the PreparedX podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello, and welcome to episode 51 of the PreparedX podcast. Before I get started, I just want to touch on this episode. It's brought to you by Group Duelists. Group Duelists centralizes team coordination during incidents, which harmonizes procedures across your organization. You should check that out. The application is an excellent application. It's groupduelists.com. That's groupduelists.com. And check that out when you get a chance. In this podcast, I interview Dr. Christopher Ankerson, who is a clinical associate professor at the Center for Global Affairs at NYU. My discussions with Chris centered around the theory of securitization and its applicability towards better understanding disasters. It's quite fascinating, a great discussion. Here's my interview with Dr. Ankerson. Good morning, Chris. How are you doing today?
Great, thanks.
Chris, just before we get started with the podcast interview, could you just, for our audience, give a little bit of background on yourself and your career to date, please?
Sure. Currently, I'm a clinical associate professor at the Center for Global Affairs at New York University, where I look into ideas around transnational security, and I teach a course in responding to emergencies, which takes emergencies in their fullest understanding, whether that be a complex emergency, a humanitarian disaster, or a domestic issue here in the United States. I'm Canadian by extraction. I spent the previous 12 years working for the United Nations all around the world, including in Southeast Asia, looking at security issues, emergency preparedness, and disaster response. As it turned out, that ended up looking like floods and coups in Thailand. It looked like civil unrest in Cambodia, as well as doing quite a number of other issues around Indonesia and across Southeast and East Asia. Prior to that, I was a Canadian infantry officer for 12 years and was involved in a number of responses, both kind of traditional security responses, peacekeeping, peace operations in the Balkans, as well as some disaster response domestically back home in Canada.
Excellent. Very impressive background. So our audience, I'm sure, will appreciate your time today and everything you have to say on this topic. So let's get into it then. When we started, you know, to discuss the topic today and you reached out to us, I thought I was intrigued by the securitization theory. So just for our listeners, before we get into the meat of it, can you just give an overview of what that is?
Sure. Let me just back up a little bit, and sometimes it sounds a bit more spooky than it really is. So when we all work in organizations in our private lives or in our professional lives, and we have things called priorities, right? Somebody declares something to be a priority. And essentially, there's two questions that come from that is, you know, what does that mean for something to be a priority? And how does it actually happen? Who actually gets to decide something is a priority? Is it a top-down single leader or decision maker sitting in a broom closet somewhere saying this is going to be a priority? Or it could be perhaps a bottom-up kind of consensus-based understanding of why something gets to be a priority. And once that decision is made, what does that actually trigger within an organization? Usually that means there's going to be resources allocated. Perhaps it's the main effort for everybody's operational line. And essentially, securitization theory, in a way, looks at that process. How does something become a security issue? Who gets to decide? How does it actually work? And it essentially describes a process which the authors of the main authors of the theory, Barry Buzan and his collaborators, basically believe that this is a political decision. And by politics, they mean somebody is making a decision about, you know, life chances, about how resources will be allocated. So securitization theory basically is a move by somebody. We can talk about who that somebody is in the questions, perhaps. But somebody is trying to convince other people that an issue of some kind poses a threat to a referent object, to something that's been identified as being at risk, shall we say. And because of that, there needs to be an emergency response. And by emergency, essentially a non-routine response. So Bazan talks about once something becomes securitized, the normal rules no longer apply. And while this has traditionally been looked at in terms of hard security issues, I think that there's a lot to be learned from that process when it comes to disaster or crisis preparation and management.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. In some ways, is this, or do we see this, or do you see this? Have you got any experience with seeing this happen? At the government level, in terms of lobbying, in terms of, a disaster happens, and then, this theory is put into play?
Sure. And I think a lot of times what we see is this theory is not intentionally or explicitly used in the sense that somebody says, hey, it's time to securitize this issue. But if we look at the work, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners will be familiar with the work of Bruce Schneier, who looks at security. And in his book, Beyond Fear, he opens up the book by saying that security is about three things. It's about trade-offs. Somebody has to make a trade-off between, are we going to spend more money on, for example, bars on the windows, or are we going to spend that on the actual, marketing and development of our product line?
Right.
So somewhere along the line, there's got to be a trade-off made. He goes on to say that those trade-offs are basically decisions that involve power relations. Somebody gets to, ultimately be the boss or the final decider and actually make those trade-offs. And then finally, he says, that person in power is not always the security person, not always the person who is responsible for, implementing the plan. So I think if we take that approach and we kind of meld that with securitization, we can see that whether somebody's explicitly saying, I'm going to take step one of the securitization theory and move it along to step two, there are these kinds of decisions being made. Sometimes, often in the academic literature, it's been used in a bit of a nefarious way, saying this issue was, wrongly securitized, or, there was kind of a conspiracy to securitize this issue. But I think that takes it a bit far. And I think within organizations, if we take it out of the government and put it into an organization, there is a little bit of lobbying. If you're a chief security officer or in charge of business continuity, you're trying to get your issues onto an agenda.
Sure.
You want your boss to understand that, hey, if we don't invest in, preparation, we're going to end up taking it in the butt when whatever that thing is that happens, and we're going to end up, having to spend it on the back end. So I think it doesn't have to be this deliberate process. It doesn't have to be this nefarious conspiracy theory, but it is a process, I think. If we keep it in mind, this is how things happen, and this is how decisions get made. It's quite instructive.
Yeah, very good explanation there. Thank you. Can you give a couple of examples, maybe recent examples, something that our audience may be familiar with, and that's in the
sure.
public eye, or that something in the background that you have experience with?
Sure. Let me the kind of classic example, and it goes back a few years, but I think it won't be beyond people's memory, is that the AIDS issue in the early 1990s ended up becoming a national security issue. President Clinton at the time declared AIDS to be a national security issue and put it on the agenda of the National Security Council domestically. And this was kind of a classic example of moving an issue from one category, public health, for example, and moving it to another category, to national security. And the kind of intention behind that was not to militarize AIDS or make it a security threat as a stigma, but in order to rally people, put it in a different priority, to make people understand that there were, that the threats from AIDS, for example, were real, that people were being affected. That's a kind of a classic example of moving an issue from one category or bucket, shall we say, into another bucket. But there are other ones that are kind of similar to that. We might look at migration, for example.
Right.
Immigration into a country. Is that a social issue that needs to be dealt with social work, with, a humanitarian response? Or is it a security issue where we're worried about vetting people and screening people, and we put people into holding facilities before we're sure that they are not going to pose a threat? So it's a deliberate understanding. It's a deliberate move by somebody to make that decision. And I think what's very important behind all of this is that the threats themselves that we look at, or the challenges we look at, don't necessarily come with a big sticker on them that said, hey, I'm a threat. It takes somebody to understand that, to analyze that, and to make a determination whether we say that is a threat and treat it accordingly, or do we see it as something else? And, you know, it's a challenge, it's the price of doing business, but it's not something that we're going to put into the emergency bucket and then treat it that way. So there are lots of examples that we can get into. For example, liquids or shoes on airplanes. For many, many years, liquids, taking a bottle of water onto an airplane or wearing your shoes when you went into an airplane was not an issue. You didn't need to be patted down or strip searched. But because of a particular incident, intelligence agencies saw that there was a threat, wasn't publicly known at the time, and they announced that from then on, you could no longer take large bottles of liquids onto planes. You could no longer, stride on through security check, mm-hmm. but with your shoes on. So there's an example of somebody, as you say, behind the scenes, made a determination, brought that to the attention of a decision maker, and quite quickly, quite rapidly, globally, became the new standard that we're used to. And I suppose in a few years, people will not even necessarily wonder why this ever came to pass. But going on in the background was a process of securitization where there was a threat recognized, and then a decision and a conversation had to happen. Some convincing had to happen by somebody to somebody else to say, hey, we need to start taking this seriously.
Sure. In your research and the notes you sent along, you talk about brief cases that you use to highlight how this point of view can shed light on the politics of disasters. Can you talk for a few minutes about that?
Sure. The overarching tagline for my research right now is accidents happen, but disasters are declared. And essentially, it goes to this idea that you can have all of this information, you can have all of these threats, some of them in plain sight, some of them, disguised. And we go about our daily business. It's not until somebody actually declares something to be an emergency or a disaster that the processes that we're used to kind of kick in. So there's a couple of examples I could use. 9/11, and I know it's a sensitive topic, but it really wasn't until the second plane flew into the second of the World Trade Center towers that we actually knew that we had a disaster. Before that, myself, like most people watching, even if we were watching on TV, we saw the first plane hit and thought, wow, that's a fluke accident. What a horrible thing to happen. But it really wasn't until the second plane hit that bystanders and decision makers said, oh, this is something different. This takes it into a different category altogether. And we take a very concrete example of that. Because of, at the time, cell phones and phone calls to loved ones, it made a very big difference to how the fourth plane, United Flight 93, reacted to that, for example. They had the information now that this was not a random incident, that there was a wider attack going on, and they took measures accordingly. That had they not had that information, had they not been informed of what was going on in New York, they probably wouldn't have done what they did over Pennsylvania at the time. So that's kind of one example of where we see very rapidly, not very formally, but we see going on simultaneously this idea of securitization, that somebody is actually moving information, and it makes, taking on additional significance and meaning and helping move those things into different categories. In the opposite direction, we can look at the recent Hawaii missile alert. Right. Where we actually had a declared disaster, but what we didn't have was an actual threat. So the declaration, sending out a text message to people saying there's an incoming missile, that's what actually prompted all the action. And this, very terrifying scenes of parents putting children into storm sewers and taking kind of, whatever that last 20 minutes of your life decision-making going on. And what we didn't have was the actual hard and fast material threat in the first place. There were no missiles coming in, but we did have a declared disaster, which actually prompted a lot of decisions and actions to take place. So that kind of shows in a way that it's not the material threats themselves that generate action. It takes that decision. And in this case, it was a very low-level decision made in error, nevertheless, it prompted a whole bunch of behaviors to kick in after that. And a kind of a middle case, in a way, is the Nepal earthquake that happened a few years ago. As a matter of fact, people were expecting the Nepal earthquake to happen, but they were expecting it to happen on a much, much larger scale. United Nations disaster response mechanisms through a whole host of agencies, bilateral response from places like the United States Marine Corps coming out of Okinawa. They had been planning for years for the big one to happen in Nepal. And because of that, they had done a lot of modeling, a lot of scenario planning. Assumptions were made about, for example, airport availability, and that there would be no way that they could land relief supplies in Kathmandu, and they would need to come in by sea and then by road in a very arduous and in some cases, kind of bulldozer leading convoys moving and clearing roads to get the disaster relief in. In the end, it didn't happen that way. The big one actually didn't take place, and the earthquake most recently was not that catastrophic. And actually, because it didn't align with the mental map that people had put in place, in a way it changed and certainly slowed some of the response that you would think, hey, you know, great, the airport's open, let's go. But it actually took different decisions and different kind of movement of resources around to realign the response with what actually happened.
Right.
So I think all of that goes to show, I think, that the securitization model, which again is not necessarily a checklist, it's not something that people follow strictly, talks a lot about how it's not the material issues at stake, it's how we interpret them and what we do about them that makes the bigger difference. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at with my research.
Sure, sure. Yeah, you also talk about a modified version of the theory. Could you just go into a little detail about that? I think you talk about it being able to help us better understand aspects of disasters.
Sure. So, I mean, what I think I mean by that is that, you know, we're not always talking about a security risk. We can talk about maybe disasterification or crisification theory, where in our daily lives, as we do business continuity, for example, within an organization, we're not always talking about security issues. We could be talking about supply chain management issues. We could be talking about things like the sewer system backing up and rendering a building, inoperable. So by taking that approach that we've seen sketched out in securitization theory and applying it to what we're doing, we can start wondering, you know, are we falling into some of those traps ourselves? And asking some very, very important questions. So, for example, Slavoj Žižek, who is a postmodern philosopher, says that it's not the event itself that is the catastrophe, it's everything that came before it that makes it a catastrophe. So what were the decisions that were made? Who made those judgments? Who should decide? Who gets to decide? Who benefits from those decisions and who suffers because of those decisions?
Right.
And I think if we take that understanding of securitization and modify it for our own organizations, where we may not be worried about security issues per se, but we're worried about supply chain risk or foreign exchange risk, or we're worried about other things like that, we need to adopt that approach and say, hey, it's not going to show up whatever this thing is, this trigger for our disaster management protocol. It's not going to necessarily walk in the front door with a big sticker on it that says, I'm the thing that you need to be worried about. There is a whole set of bureaucratic, you call it political, call it whatever you want, human judgment processes that are going to happen that alert us to or don't alert us to these kinds of issues. And I think that's what I mean by modifying it, taking that on board and saying, hey, I really need to wonder how, you know, in our plan in black and white, it's very easy. You know, event happens, kicks off a whole bunch of processes, but there might be a little bit of a slip between event happening and us understanding it and then us declaring it to be, you know, worthy of our attention.
Yeah, I mean, we you know, just your last comments there on the last question, it makes me think about the crisis simulation exercise that we conduct here at PreparedX. I'm sure you've been through a vast amount of them. And, you know, in your experience with those exercises as it relates to the theory and the outcomes of those and the lessons, we like to call them lessons to be learned. What's your experience in that area?
Yeah, I think that, and you know, you're absolutely right. We all go through these crisis management exercises, but I think, and I've just been through one relatively recently myself, I think in a way what we do is we know already this is going to be a crisis. Why? Because we've been called together to do a crisis management exercise. We're sitting around a table, or perhaps we're even in separate rooms, but we're aware, we're already primed to the fact that we're going to be presented with a challenge that needs a response. And that's great because, let's be honest, we all need practice with those kinds of things. We all need practice with pulling the lever and making the processes happen. But that's not very realistic in the sense that we don't get called together. That whole decision to call together a crisis management team is exactly where securitization comes in. What happened before that meeting actually took place? Now, we tend to use, you know, videos of trees falling down and knocking out, you know, power cables, et cetera. And in some cases, yes, it's going to be very obvious. That is a threat. It's going to trigger some kind of response, or that is going to disrupt our business. We need to put something in place. But I think the problem with a lot of exercises is we're already, you know, X plus one along that process. That decision has been made. Here we are sitting here. We are going to get some decisions made for the next 2 hours, 3 hours, 8 hours. We are going to manage a crisis. Where I think we need to be a little bit more, I think, aware is, how are we actually going to get to that table in the first place?
Right.
And are we going to miss something? How many hours down the road is it going to be? Was there an insider threat, for example, that was going on to bring you know, 3 or 4 months of problems before we're actually aware of it? Is it a slow kind of, you know, drip, drip, drip kind of disaster that we actually are suffering for many, many weeks or days before the incident, and then it's only once we're aware of it that we call this to be a disaster? Or in some cases, we might have the good fortune to call that kind of preparation meeting before the disaster happens, because we kind of read the tea leaves and understand. We don't necessarily predict things, but we anticipate, and we make some of those decisions beforehand. So I think understanding a securitization mindset in that there's going to have to be recognition and determination before those incidents happen, that can be quite healthy. And whether companies are ready to, you know, have an out-of-the-blue surprise crisis management exercise, that would take a huge amount of buy-in from senior management, but that might be a little bit more realistic, you know, in the sense that it's a surreptitious sneaking up on you, you know, a disaster rather than something that's a lightning bolt out of the sky and everybody's quite clearly
right.
on side.
Yeah. We typically call that those no notice exercises. And again, it's really, we don't see that until the organization is, you know, a little more advanced. And so it often starts off with those, you know, very well scripted, if you will, sessions where we know we're coming into that environment. Still important to go through from the basic roles and responsibilities point of view, but not many actually go much further. We do full-scale exercises, I'm sure, again, with your experience, you've been through a number of those as well, which, you know, again, much more realistic. So this has been fantastic. Really appreciate your time today, Chris. Before we head out, have you got any final comments for our listeners? And if they want to get a hold of you and want to chat some more with you about your research, or want to get a hold of the research, how can they contact you?
Sure. I'm quite happy to talk about this. I would love to talk about it through with people in terms of their own cases. So, for example, you know, how do they see what happened, you know, the bad thing that happened to them in their kind of context? Can we see that there actually was a securitization moment there that happened and people weren't aware of, or perhaps a moment that was missed that could have been exploited? That would be fantastic. I can forward you the details and you can put them up on your site or put them in, or I can just, you know, read out my email address now, whatever you think is best, Rob.
If you read it out, and we'll also link back, if you've got a LinkedIn profile, we'll link back to that as well.
Sure. So you can get a hold of me at Christopher.Ankersen, A-N-K-E-R-S-E-N, at NYU.edu.
Perfect. Appreciate that. Again, thanks for your time today. We look forward to being in touch with you again in the future, and have a great afternoon.
Thanks, Rob.
Take care. That wraps up our 51st podcast. If you liked it, please rate us on iTunes or the other outlets, wherever you're listening to this. That's really important to us. Or make a comment if you're listening to this podcast through our website. Make a comment right underneath the podcast. We'd appreciate the feedback. Again, until next time, have a safe and productive day. Thank you.